The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everybody. Hello. I'm not Jill Lepore. My name is Ben Yagoda. I want to welcome you to the library and ask you to please take a minute to silence your cell phones and also to remind you that no flash photography is allowed during the event. Following the lecture, a book signing will take place upstairs in the lobby. And also just a reminder that for this and other author events programs, they are offered as podcasts on freelibrary.org. As I say, my name is Ben Yagoda. I'm a professor of journalism and English at the University of Delaware and author of a history of the New Yorker magazine called About Town. When I was asked to introduce Jill Lepore, I naturally went on Facebook to say that I had been asked to introduce Jill Lepore, because that's what one does nowadays. And also to ask my friends for advice on what to say. I was frankly a little intimidated. I got a lot of responses. I actually got even more responses than when I posted a cute picture of my dog, which is really saying something. One person who's a professor of history wrote, "Journalism and history are two very different genres and callings. Jill Lepore is making a synthesis of them both look much easier than it is." Another, who's a woman who lives in upstate New York, said, "I'm such a JL fangirl that I would consider coming down for this." I don't think, is Emily Gordon here? I don't think she did. No. I think my favorite was this one. A woman said, "There must be three of her." That's something I've often felt myself. After all, how could one person manage to write so much and so well? Unfortunately, I have to report, unfortunately for the rest of us slacker writers, the evidence I've been able to gather this evening is that there is only one Jill Lepore, although I still won't absolutely reject the idea that there are some clones out there right now, maybe giving a speech at the Free Library of Pittsburgh or something like that. Whether it's one or three Lepores, her record is remarkable. She received a PhD in American Studies from Yale in 1995, came to Harvard in 2003. 2 years after that, became chair of the History and Literature program there. In 2012, she was named Harvard College Professor in recognition of her distinction in undergraduate teaching. I first encountered her, and many of you probably did as well, in her contributions to the New Yorker magazine, where she has been a contributor since 2005 and a staff writer since 2008. I went on the website of the New Yorker today and calculated that since 2005, she has contributed what I find an astonishing 126 pieces to the magazine on subjects ranging from, and I won't give the full range of her subjects, but one of her first pieces was on Noah Webster's Dictionary. That was a memorable piece I still remember, to her most recent one on the presidency of Woodrow Wilson. Now, that's 126. Just for the sake of comparison, I tried to look to see how many a well-known writer like Malcolm Gladwell had contributed. 46. And he doesn't even have any teaching duties. And I haven't even mentioned her books. Like all of her work, they're a combination of scholarly rigor and literary excellence. Some of her books include The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death, The Story of America, Essays on Origins, The Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution and the Battle for American History. By the way, that's the real Tea Party. New York Burning, Liberty, Slavery, and Conspiracy in 18th Century Manhattan, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and The Name of War, King Philip's War and the Origins of American History, which won the Bancroft Prize, the biggest prize in American history. She's also the co-author of Blind Spot, a novel set in and written in the style of an 18th century novel. That brings me to her latest book, which we'll discuss tonight, The Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. This morning, some of you might have happened to hear Dr. Lepore's appearance on Radio Times. I didn't catch that. I had to teach myself, but I did hear the promo for it this morning on WHYY, after which the announcer said incredulously, "Ben Franklin had a little sister?" Which I guess is sort of the point. Ladies and gentlemen of Ben Franklin's hometown, please welcome Jill Lepore.
Good evening. Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. I now have to join Facebook just to see the picture of your dog. Because I have to post some comments, because I feel a little bad outranking the comment numbers. It's so nice to be here. Thank you all for coming. It's such a treat, first of all, to be in Philadelphia, Franklin's hometown, to talk about Jane, who once visited here and didn't love it as much as she loved Boston. Also just to be here in a public library and celebrate this space and all that it stands for. So thank you to the library. I am hoping that none of you have ever heard of Jane Franklin, because I want to tell you the story of her life, and we don't have that much time to do it. She led a rich and fascinating life, and I'm going to try to give you a whirlwind tour of it, and we're going to be looking at some slides, and I even have props. That's how I teach. So sit back and listen to this tale that I hope is unknown to you. In 1771, Benjamin Franklin sent his sister Jane a pair of spectacles. Or rather, he sent her 13 pairs of spectacles with lenses of every size from 1 to 13. And he sent her 2 instructions for conducting her own eye exam. This is like, you know when you're at the optometrist and they put that horrible thing over your face and they flick the lenses and you have to say, like, which is better, A or B, and do they all look the same? This is what Benjamin wrote to Jane. "Take out a pair at a time and hold one of the glasses first against one eye and then against the other, looking on some small print. If the first pair suits neither eye, put them up again before you open a second. I advise your trying of each of your eyes separately, because few people's eyes are fellows." I love that. So the question this raises for me as a biographer trying to write about Benjamin and Jane Franklin, what does it mean to be one of a pair and not be fellows? Benjamin Franklin was born, alas, not here in Philadelphia, but in Boston, my hometown, in 1706. He would surely have been a Red Sox fan. I think that's clear. His sister Jane was born 6 years later. This is from the Franklin family record book chronicling their births. He was the youngest of 10 sons. She was the youngest of 7 daughters. That's 17. Benny and Jenny, they were called when they were little. No two people in their family were more alike. Jane thought of her brother as her second self, she said. They were, after a fashion, twins in a way, like a pair of eyes. They posed, though, a biographical dilemma, because their lives could hardly have been more different. Benjamin Franklin ran away from home when he was 17. His sister never left. He taught himself to write with wit and force and style. She never learned how to spell. The day he turned 21, he wrote her a letter. She was 14, beginning a correspondence that would last until his death 63 years later. He became a printer, a philosopher, and a statesman. She became a wife, a mother, and a widow. He signed the Declaration of Independence, the Treaty of Paris, and the Constitution. She strained to form the letters of her name. He loved no one longer. She loved no one better. Benjamin Franklin wrote more letters to his sister Jane than he wrote to anyone else. And all her life, she wrote back, letter after letter filled with news and recipes and gossip. and when she was truly sorely vexed, and only then, with her blistering opinions about politics. Franklin, as you know, I think you guys know more about Benjamin Franklin than I do, but you know that he wrote the story of his life, The Private Life of Benjamin Franklin, it was called when it was first published. A well-turned tale about a boy who runs away from a life of poverty and obscurity and cramped, pious Boston, and leaves all that behind, leaves home behind, leaves his sister behind, leaves ignorance behind, leaves the past behind, to become an enlightened, education, independent man of the world. A man of books, a man of learning, a man of science, a man of papers, a man of letters, a spectacle. 1771, the year Benjamin Franklin sent his sister Jane eyeglasses, is also the year he began writing that story of his life. It wasn't published until his death in 1790. But Benjamin Franklin's autobiography is one of the most important autobiographies ever written. It helped even invent the word. The word autobiography wasn't coined until 1797, 7 years later. His was a private life made public. It's also an allegory about America. The story of a man as the story of a nation. Self-made, rags to riches. The story of America, a spectacle for all the world to see. In that story, he left his sister out. Never once did he so much as mention her. Where does that leave her unfortunate biographer? One half the world does not know how the other half lives, Franklin once wrote. His sister, I think, is his other half. And if his life is an allegory, so is hers. But an allegory for what? Her life was not a spectacle. None of you have ever heard of her before. It is very difficult even to see her life. Next to his, her life seems so tiny. His fame is matched only by her obscurity. If he's a spectacle, she's a speck. But I wondered then, might there be a kind of eyeglasses that could help us to see them both at once? No portrait of Jane survives like this iconic portrait of Franklin. She can't be seen in that way. There are, of course, dozens of portraits of her brother. His popularity, he wrote to her from France, has occasioned so many paintings to be made of me that my face is now almost as well known as that of the moon. She wrote back, yeah, and it's just as changeable. He liked very much to be portrayed wearing his spectacles. They were a kind of trademark for him. The historian Catherine Stebbins McCaffrey has found that Franklin is wearing his spectacles in more than a third of all of his surviving portraits. This is the case when there are almost no other 18th century portraits of anyone wearing eyeglasses. It's a quite unusual thing. Franklin liked this portrait the best. Why did he care so much about being seen wearing these spectacles? Well, the story of spectacles in early America is the story about reading. Spectacles were an emblem of a life of the mind. People have used glass as a magnifier, of course, for a very long time. But eyeglasses, pieces of glass cut and framed to be held up before your eyes, became common commodities not until well into the 17th century, when they were used exclusively for reading. If you were literate, you might have eyeglasses. You never would have eyeglasses if you were not literate. The rise of eyeglasses, then, is actually inseparable from the rise of printing and the expansion of literacy. People used spectacles to read printed books. You can see the first popular advertisement for spectacles from London here from 1644. This is what eyeglasses looked like and how they were described. These are called nose spectacles or bridge spectacles. They just sit on the bridge of your nose. There's a great portrait from early New England, Richard Mather, the minister of Dorchester here in 1670, holding them in his hand. You can see, they're very tiny. But they're always in these portraits associated with books, right? Because the whole point of having spectacles was in order to read a book. But the very fact, the existence of spectacles, even though not many people had them, only very learned people had them, and they only used them for reading, in an age of Isaac Newton's optics, actually inspired all kinds of different thinking about seeing and the act of sight. Things and ideas about perspective and point of view and distortion. So John Donne, for instance, observed that when thou lookest through spectacles, small things seem great. Spectacles made small things bigger. Wearing them, thinking about them, also inspired reflection on the nature and the boundaries of the self and of moral imagination. John Locke wrote, I think we may as rationally hope to see with other men's eyes as to know by other men's understandings. What if you could see through another man's eyes the way you can look through a pair of glasses? Richard Steele, writing in the aptly named Spectator, wrote in 1711 that a man's eyes are spectacles to those who look at him to read his heart. What if you could see through the eyes into the heart? Wearing spectacles, then, was not a small thing for Benjamin Franklin. It marked him as a man of discernment. More plainly, they marked him as a prodigious reader, which he was. Jane always said that when he was a very young child, Benny had learned to read, and that he had studied incessantly and was addicted to reading. Their father was a poor candle maker, but he decided to send Benny to school because this young boy was clearly so brilliant. He had put all of his other sons to trades, apprenticed them, but he decided to give one of his sons, a tenth of his sons, to the church. That meant training him to go to Harvard by teaching him Latin and Greek. So in 1714, when Jenny was 2 and Benny was 8, he entered school, a grammar school, and studied Latin and Greek in order to prepare for the ministry. Franklin spent only 2 years there before his father pulled him out, sent him to a cheaper school, and then pulled him out of that school too in order to keep him at home to help make candles. Franklin hated it. Jenny's parents, though, could not have sent her to school at all, even if they'd been of a mind to. No public school in 18th century Boston admitted girls. Beginning in 1701, poor laws in Massachusetts required that families ought to teach boys to read and to write, and girls to read. Girls were not commonly taught to write in the 18th century. They were taught instead to stitch. 3 in 5 women could not even sign their names. And when you think about it, knowing how to sign your name doesn't actually is not an indication of literacy or any, it's really just a mechanical act. Most of those 3 in 5 women who could sign their names could not actually write. A Boston newspaper printed a dialogue between a thriving tradesman and his wife about the education of their daughter that gives you a glimpse of 18th century ideas about women. The mother wishes to send her daughter to school. The husband refuses, telling her, "Prithee, good madam, let her first be able to read a chapter truly in the Bible, that she mayn't mispronounce God's people popal, nor read constable for Constantinople. Make her expert and ready at her prayers, that God may keep her from the devil's snares. Teach her what's useful, how to shun deluding, to roast, to toast, to boil and mix a pudding, to knit, to spin, to sew, to make or mend, to scrub, to rub, to earn, and not to spend. I tell thee, wife, once more, I'll have her bred to bookery, cookery, thimble, needle, and thread." This was Jane Franklin's education. She was bred to bookery, cookery, thimble, needle, and thread. She cut the wick and dipped the candles, the work that her brother hated. She boiled soap. Why on earth did Benjamin Franklin one day need to send her spectacles? If girls never learned to read or to write, or they learned to read but not to write, why did Jane Franklin one day need glasses? Jane Franklin did learn to read because most girls did. But she was no ordinary reader. She read passionately, she read avidly, she read the whole of her life. And she learned, too, how to write, which was quite an unusual thing. I think her brother taught her. Benjamin Franklin, from boyhood, fought for his learning letter by letter, book by book, candle by candle. He valued nothing more, and he loved no one better than his little sister. But it was cruel in its kindness, because when he left, the lessons ended. In 1717, when Jenny was 5, her brother James set up a printing shop in Boston. It was a godsend for Benjamin Franklin, because here at last was a trade for a bookish boy whose family were too poor to send him to Harvard. He became his brother's apprentice, a printer's devil, and he moved out of the house into a room above his brother's shop. He was 12, Jenny was 6. Being a printer's apprentice gave Franklin all kinds of opportunity to read. It was the best part of the apprenticeship, he always said. He read and he read and he read. He read every book that passed through that shop. He also read books that he borrowed from a friend of his named John Collins. He sat up reading all night long. He and his friend John liked to trade books and also to stage debates as if they were university men. They used to pretend that they were Harvard students. The only debate he remembered well enough to write about in his autobiography, though, was a debate he had with his friend John Collins over the propriety of educating the female sex in learning and about their abilities for study. Collins was of the opinion that it was improper and that girls were unequal to it. Franklin disagreed. He took the contrary side. Maybe he was thinking of Jane. In crafting his argument, Franklin leaned on a book written by Daniel Defoe called Essays on Projects. Defoe had proposed the establishment of an academy for women writing. I have often thought of it as one of the most barbarous customs in the world, considering us as a civilized and Christian country, that we deny the advantages of learning to women. He regretted the frivolousness of girls' education. Their youth is spent to teach them to stitch and sew or make baubles. They are taught to read and maybe to write their names, and that is the height of a woman's education. Defoe proposed an academy for women that would hold back from them no sort of learning to such whose geniuses would lead them to it. This was the argument Benjamin Franklin as a young boy made in this debate with his best friend, following Defoe's arguments about the need for women's education. Franklin lost the argument. He had actually carried on a lot of the argument by writing. He and his friend would sort of rebut each other in prose, and they exchanged these letters. Franklin's father came across the pile of papers and read both the arguments, and then he critiqued it and told Franklin that he was not anywhere near as strong a writer as his friend John Collins. Franklin learned a great lesson about how to write and how to argue in the course of that debate. But think about what that means. Well, Benjamin Franklin was improving his prose by arguing about the education of girls. Sister Jane was at home dipping candles and stitching. Quietly, though, with what time she could spare, she seems to have been doing more. She once wrote to her brother, "I read as much as I dare." In 1721, Jenny and Benny's brother James bought his first pair of spectacles in a shop in Boston. He was 24. He also started printing a newspaper, the New England Courant. Benny, his apprentice, set the type. But what Benny really wanted to do was to write for this newspaper. He knew his brother would never let him, so he disguised his handwriting, and he gave himself a pen name, and he slipped a contribution under the newspaper's door, under the printing shop door. The pen name he gave himself was, of course, Silence Duguid. She introduced herself by way of remarks about the art of biography. This is the first Silence Duguid essay. "Histories of lives are seldom entertaining unless they contain something either admirable or exemplary. And since there is little or nothing of this nature in my own adventures, I will not tire your readers with tedious particulars of no consequence, but will briefly and with as few words as possible relate the most material occurrences from my life, and according to my promise, confine all to this letter." Doesn't this make you want to go read 18th century stuff? This is so awesome. Is that not awesome? Franklin wrote in the voice of Mrs. Silence Duguid, a widow, a woman. She had to explain, because she knew how to write, how she came by her education. If you read any woman writing in the 18th century, the first thing she says is, "Let me explain to you how it is that I can be a woman writer, because it seems an impossibility." Her story was that her father and mother had died, and she had been given as a charge to a minister who had very liberal views about education. Silence Duguid explains, "He endeavored that I might be instructed in all that knowledge and learning which is necessary for a sex, and denied me no accomplishment that could possibly be obtained, such as all sorts of needlework, writing, arithmetic. And observing that I took more than ordinary delight in reading ingenious books, he gave me the free use of his library, which, though it was but small, yet it was well chose to inform the understanding brightly and enable the mind to form great and noble ideas." Silence Duguid, in explaining the story of her life, said she had spent her childhood with the best of company, books. So think about this moment now. Here, Jenny is 10, Benny is 16. He breaks out upon the literary stage. This is the thing Franklin is most famous for writing at this point in his life. Disguised as a woman whose girlhood was spent reading books. Silence Duguid was Jane Franklin. Benjamin Franklin ran away from home in 1723. Came here, of course, to wonderful Philadelphia. He was 17. Jane was 11. She was a reader. She somehow inspired Silence Duguid. Was she a writer? Virginia Woolf once asked, "What would have happened if William Shakespeare had had a wonderfully gifted sister? Let's imagine her name is Judith." Woolf gave herself permission to invent Judith Shakespeare. "Let us imagine, since facts are so hard to come by," she said, and conjured a girl as brilliant and daring as her brother. She was as adventurous, as imaginative, as agog to see the world as he was. I can't do a Virginia Woolf accent, or else I would. But it's like, imagine Virginia Woolf. "But she was not sent to school. She had no chance of learning grammar and logic, let alone of reading Horace and Virgil." That's like BBC. Sounds bad. Like bad Downton Abbey. She picked up a book now and then, one of her brothers perhaps, and read a few pages. But then her parents came in and told her to mend the stockings or mind the stew and not moon about with books and papers. What, Woolf wondered. This is a thought experiment of Woolf's, this famous thought experiment. What would have happened to this Judith Shakespeare? Before she was out of her teens, She was to be betrothed to the son of a neighboring wool stapler. She cried, like, that's the worst possible fate. Like, what does a wool stapler even do? She cried out that marriage was hateful to her, and for that she was severely beaten by her father. Then he ceased to scold her. He begged her instead not to hurt him, not to shame him in this matter of her marriage. He would give her a chain of beads or a fine petticoat, he said, and there were tears in his eyes. How could she disobey him? How could she break his heart? Well, in this fiction, Judith Shakespeare does break her father's heart. She runs away to London. She becomes an actress. Then she's seduced by a theater company manager. She's made with child by him. And then Wolfe writes, who shall measure the heat and violence of the poet's heart when caught and tangled in a woman's body? She killed herself one winter's night. That's what happens to Judith Shakespeare. So a question you might ask is, this what's going to happen to Jane Franklin? Well, Judith Shakespeare is, of course, a figment of Virginia Woolf's imagination. She's a heroine trapped, skirts aflutter, and actually a rather modern and manly idea of the self, and of the author as self, solitary and unencumbered, a free man. Judith Shakespeare killed herself because she was pregnant, because she could not reconcile a life of the mind or of the artist with a life of a mother. Neither could Virginia Woolf. The facts of Jane Franklin's life are very hard to come by. Most of what she wrote is lost, and what scant record of her life is left has been saved only because she was Benjamin Franklin's sister. But Jane Franklin is not a figment of my imagination. She was flesh and blood and milk and tears. Her brother ran away and broke their father's heart. She would not, she could not. She never gave herself that much ruth. She didn't kill herself one winter's night. She never gave herself that kind of rope either. She had too many people to look after. She never left anyone behind. Her whole life, she hardly ever left the house. She didn't have a room of her own until she was 69 years old. I write now in my own little chamber and nobody up in the house near to disturb me, she wrote, delighted. She was very happy to have that room, but not having it sooner isn't why she didn't write more or better. In 1723, after Benjamin Franklin ran away and settled here in Philadelphia, where he opened a printing shop like his brother, a revolution in eyewear began. When this kind of eyeglasses, which is called a temple spectacle, was invented, it had arms, temple arms. Franklin started selling these kinds of spectacles at his shop here in Philadelphia in 1730 when he was 24. Which is also when he began wearing them. The same age his brother James had started wearing spectacles, had needed to wear glasses. At first, he probably only wore them for reading like most other people did, but before long, he started wearing them constantly. He would walk up and down Market Street wearing his eyeglasses, and people would laugh like, what are you doing? Don't you know they're actually only for reading? But he would use a different pair when he was outside so he could see distance, because he realized he had two kinds of problems with his sight. Not long after he began wearing spectacles, Benjamin Franklin, of course, invented bifocals. He later explained, I had formerly two pairs of spectacles, which I shifted occasionally, as in traveling. I sometimes read, and I often wanted to regard the prospects, finding this change troublesome, always having to take off one pair of glasses. If you ever have reading glasses, you know how troublesome this is. And not having my other pair sufficiently ready, I instead had the glasses cut, and half of each kind associated in the same circle. By this means, as I wear my spectacles constantly, I have only to move my eyes up or down as I want to see distinctly far or near, the proper glasses being always ready. It's almost as if Franklin has left for me a little clue, like a code explaining how to write a biography of two people who are very different, like a binocular biography. I think there's a lesson here in the writing of history. Few people's eyes are fellows. Franklin wrote to his sister that day he sent her spectacles. Our eyes look alike, but they see differently, he told her. Almost everybody in reading uses one eye principally, the other dimmer or fitter for distant objects. One eye might be nearsighted, the other far. One day you might need to see far, one day you might need to see near. She needed, he told her, two different lenses because she had two different eyes. The historian, I think, needs two different lenses too. One to see up close and one to see far away. One to write the life of the great man, Benjamin Franklin, and one to write the life of the small woman. I got actually completely obsessed with this idea of a binocular biography when I was trying to write a life of Jane Franklin. It seemed to solve to me so many different problems at once. And I thought, oh, if only I had a pair of these glasses. And I got to wondering what they look like, what the ones that Jane had looked like. There is actually no 18th century portrait of a woman actually wearing spectacles. There are, however, a few of women holding them. And there's one of a woman, here's another woman, you can see her glasses down. So they always have the book, it's always the glasses in the book, the glasses in the book, because the book's, I am a learned woman, I know how to read, is what this says, this portrait. I'm a very learned woman, I know how to read. Okay, this one is very Hillary Clinton. You know how she always has her glasses up like that? She think that looks like Hillary Clinton. So this is the closest I've found of a woman actually wearing glasses, and she's not wearing. She's just like, I'm brainy, like I'm a brainy. But every 18th century female portrait of a woman wearing spectacles or holding spectacles, they've got a book with them, and they're really quite similar conventionally. Anyway, I decided I needed a pair of these glasses. Like, just that would be helpful, right? Wouldn't you think that would be helpful? So I bought these at an online shop. These, and I have them here. And you'll notice the motto of the shop is pretty interesting. So these are the glasses. They're very, I was going to get my prescription put in them, but it was too expensive and I'm cheap, but I can't see a thing. Okay, but I put them on, and I would pass them around, but I don't think it's a big crowd. Use your imagination. Okay, but if you have glasses, take your glasses off for a minute. It's like a bookish crowd. Everybody has glasses. Okay. Think about the way that wearing spectacles changes your sense of yourself. Put them back on. Okay, I have to put my actual glasses on because I can't read my notes. When you have your glasses on, it's suddenly, think about how weird, very few people had glasses, right? So it's a weird thing to put them on. It would be like wearing Google Glass or something today, like something just really uncommon. When you put your glasses on, you suddenly got an inside and an outside to your head. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a window on the house of your soul. People really felt that way, that you could see into someone through their glasses. Maybe even if I were to put these Jane Franklin glasses on, I could peer into Jane Franklin's heart. So that was what I was thinking. So putting on my, Jane Franklin bifocals, I thought about Benjamin Franklin, and I thought about Virginia Woolf. And then I looked at them side by side. And that is pretty interesting right there, isn't it? Because you can see they share a posture, a pose, a worldview, a notion of selfhood, a notion of a writer's life. This is a vision of how an author works. This is a vision of the author as solitary and alone and isolated in a room of her own, with her papers in her desk, the author unencumbered by anyone else's needs. That is the story told in both of these portraits, the very same story. And it's also the story that Franklin tells in his autobiography and why he has to leave his sister out of it. Jane Franklin was not unencumbered. If there were a portrait of her, it would not look like this. She was hardly ever alone. She also never wrote the story of her life. It would never have occurred to her to do that. She did once, though, stitch 4 sheets of foolscap between 2 covers to make a little book of 16 pages. This is the cover of it. I made a facsimile. So I told you I had props. So I brought in my facsimile, which I'm also not going to pass around because it's kind of precious to me. This is the actual size of Jane Franklin's autobiography. It's 4 pages ripped out and folded and ripped and stitched with this very coarse thread. I made it with, fake 18th century paper, and then I put on my goofy glasses. I was trying really hard to transport myself. But when I went to see this little book that Jane made, it exists in an archive in Boston. It is very small, it's humble, it's quite plain, as you can see. On its first page, she wrote 3 words, Book of Ages. What the hell does that mean? I just didn't know. Like, what does that mean? It's not an autobiography. It is a book of ages. It is a list of the births and deaths of her 12 children. It is a litany of grief. It is a record in brief of a life lived not rags to riches, but rags to rags. And the hardest thing about reading Jane Franklin's Book of Ages is that it is 16 pages, but as I turned them, I discovered that she had left most of its pages blank. Has she nothing more to say? I was filled with despair sitting in that archive. Like, my glasses were useless. What was I thinking that I could actually know this woman and write about her? But I put my glasses on and I thought about buying bifocals, and I looked at those pages one more time. And sitting in that archive, holding these sheets of foolscap stitched together with these coarse threads, looking at that blank page through Jane Franklin's spectacles, I began to think that Jane Franklin actually had something to say after all. And so very delicately, I once more turned the brittle pages of her Book of Ages. And in them, I saw an unwritten story, a history of books and papers, a history of reading and writing, a Book of Ages about ages of books. So I just want to tell you a little bit about how that story works. I thought first about the book itself. Her paper was made from rags, soaked and pulped and strained and dried. Her thread was made from flax, combed and spun and twisted and dyed. On a table, she had laid down a sheet of foolscap and smoothed it with the palms of her hands. She creased it and folded it and folded it again. She pressed it open. She used a needle to stitch a seam. It is no thicker than a patch of burlap. But then she dipped the nub of a pen slipped from the feather of a bird into a pot of ink boiled of oil mixed with soot and wrote, Book of Ages, in this flourishing hand, a hand that she would have learned out of a book her brother printed in Philadelphia called The American Instructor or Young Man's Best Companion. Boys learned how to write through books that Benjamin Franklin printed. She turned the page and wrote, Jane Franklin, born March 27, 1712. Her writing is a little bit difficult to read, so I'm going to just give you a transcription of it here. Below, she wrote, Edward Meekham, married to Jane Franklin, the 27th of July, 1727. The Book of Ages, her age, is the first age we learn. Born March 27, 1712, married July 27, 1727. 15 years, 4 months. She was a child when she married. The legal age for marriage in Massachusetts was 16. The average age was 24, which, except for Jane, is the average age at which her sisters were married, and also the age at which Benjamin Franklin was married. It was extremely unusual to marry at the age of 15. It was also illegal. Edward Meekham, the man she married, was poor. He was a saddler. He was a Scot. He wore a wig and a beaver hat. She never once wrote anything about him expressing the least affection. She hardly ever wrote anything about him at all. Below, she wrote, Josiah Meekham, their firstborn, Wednesday, June the 4th, 1729. And then added one line more, and died May the 18th, 1730. The child of her childhood died 3 weeks shy of his first birthday. A dead child is a sight no more surprising than a broken pitcher, Cotton Mather preached in a sermon called Right Thoughts in Sad Hours. 1 in 4 children died before the age of 10. They were wrapped in linen, dipped in melted wax, while a box of pine was built and painted black. Puritans banned prayers for the dead. At the graveside, there would be no sermon, nor, ministers warned, ought there to be any tears. A token for mourners or the advice of Christ to a distressed mother bewailing the death of her dear and only son, a sermon printed in Boston the year Jane's first child died, cited Luke, Chapter 17, verse 13, weep not. What remains of a life like this? Remains means what remains of the body after death, but remains are also unpublished papers, and our descendants, our children, are our remains. The Boston poet Anne Bradstreet wrote about her children as my little babes, my dear remains. But Bradstreet's poems were her children too. She called them, thou ill-formed offspring of my feeble brain. Her words were all that her children would one day have left of her, she knew. She wrote, if chance to thine eyes shall bring this verse, kiss this paper. Jane did not know how to write a poem. She couldn't have afforded a gravestone for this child. Instead, she went home and wrote a book of remembrance. Kiss this paper. In 1733, Jane Franklin Meekham turned 21. She came of age. From Philadelphia, her brother sent her the gift of a book, a copy of The Ladies' Library in 3 volumes. On its flyleaf, Jane wrote with great pride, Jane Meekham, her book given to her by her brother, Benjamin Franklin, 1733. Franklin, of course, as all of you know, knew a great deal about libraries. In 1731, he had founded the first lending library in America, the Library Company of Philadelphia. He printed up charge slips for borrowers. Jane had her own ideas about libraries. On the title page of her copy of The Ladies' Library, she inscribed her name. No, I guess I remember that slide. She inscribed her name inside, Jane Meekham. She once lent the second volume to Franklin's wife, writing on its blank page, borrowed of Sister Meekham, so that she'd be sure she would get it back. Benjamin Franklin once explained what the Library Company of Philadelphia had meant to him. This library afforded me the means of improvement by constant study, for which I set apart an hour or two each day, and thus repaired in some degree the loss of the learned education my father had once intended for me. I think he meant the ladies' library to do the same for his sister. But it only went so far. Franklin had founded in Philadelphia a gentleman's library. To his sister he gave the ladies' library, a book whose radical premise was stated on the first page of the first volume, which read, It is a great injustice to shut books of knowledge from the eyes of women. Repair the loss, open the book, kiss the paper. Jane Franklin gave birth to 12 children in 24 years. Her belly swelled and emptied and swelled again. Her breasts filled and emptied and filled again. Her days were days of flesh, the little legs and little arms, the little hands clutched around her neck. A baby in her arms, she stared into kettles and tubs, swaying. The days passed to months, the months to years, and in her book of ages, she pressed her children between the pages. Her husband fell into debt. He may have gone mad. 2 of her sons became violently insane. They had to be locked up. Jane and her children lived with her parents, whom she nursed in their old age. She gave birth to 12 children in 24 years and buried 10 of them. She wrote to her brother, Sorrows roll upon me like the waves upon the sea. I am hardly allowed to fetch time to fetch my breath. I am broken with breach upon breach. And she begged God, citing Job, What have I more? She found comfort in her book of ages, and in the books she read, books her brother sent her. She read and she read. I've spent years trying to reconstruct her library. She usually wrote her name in the books she owned, here, like her brother's experiments on electricity. She once wrote to him and asked him to send her all the pamphlets and papers that have been printed of your writing. She wanted to read all the political pieces he had ever written. He wrote back, I could as easily make a collection for you of the past pairings of my nails. But he sent what he could. It was politics that she loved best. I keep your books of philosophy and politics by me, though I have read through them several times, and when I am dull, I take one up and read, and it seems as though I were conversing with you or hearing you, she once wrote. I find a pleasure in that. She asked him, too, for books written by other authors, books she'd heard about, books she were keen to read. She read Swift and Pope, Addison and Sharp. She read newspapers and magazines. She read novels and history. She read sermons and speeches. She read whatever she could get her hands on. She read until her eyes grew strained. If Jane's eyes were like her 2 brothers, she would have needed reading glasses by the age of 24. But women, of course, did not commonly wear spectacles. It's not just that you don't see them in portraits. In the inventories of people's belongings taken at their deaths, if it's a woman in the house, she does not have spectacles. Women did not have spectacles. They did not own them. But in 1771, Jane wrote to Benjamin Franklin and asked him to send her some. He was living in London. He sent her those 13 pairs. That same year, Massachusetts, for the first time, required that girls be taught to write. Ideas about female education were finally changing. Support for the education of girls grew rapidly in the years following the American Revolution, and with the rise in women's education came a rise in the female ownership of eyeglasses. All the portraits I've shown you of women holding glasses, these portraits we looked at earlier, these are from the 1780s and 1790s. Before this, you never see women even holding glasses because women were not thought to be learned in any way. These are both from 1787. In the company of books and the company of her own mind near the end of her life, Jane Franklin became a radical. A reader who liked politics and philosophy best, she absorbed some of the most radical ideas of the 18th century. I just want to tell you one last story about a book she read in 1786 when she was 74 years old. She'd raised her children and her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren and buried most of them. She put on her spectacles and she read a book called Four Dissertations, written by Richard Price, a Welsh clergyman and political radical. One objection to the idea that everything in life is fated by providence, Price wrote, is the failure to thrive. Many perish in the womb, and many more are nipped in the bloom, he wrote. An elm produces 300,000 seeds a year, but very few of these seeds ever grow into trees. A spider lays 600 eggs, and yet very few grow into spiders. So too for humans. Thousands of Boyles and Clarks and Newtons, Isaac Newton, geniuses, have probably been lost to the world and lived and died in ignorance and meanness, merely for want of being placed in favorable situations and enjoying proper advantages. No one dies for naught, Price believed, but that doesn't mean suffering can't be protested. At her desk, with Price's four dissertations pressed open and with her spectacles resting on her nose, Jane wrote a letter to her brother. Dr. Price thinks thousands of Boyles and Clarks and Newtons have probably been lost to the world, she wrote. To this, she added an opinion of her own. Very few we know is able to beat through all impediments and arrive to any great degree of superiority and understanding. Benjamin Franklin knew, and his sister knew even better, that very few ever beat through 300,000 seeds to make one elm, 600 eggs to make one spider. Of the 17 children of Josiah Franklin, how many? Very few, nearly none, only one. Or possibly two, a pair. Jane Franklin died in 1794. What remains of her life? Her Book of Ages is stored in an archive in Boston. Her spectacles do not survive. Of the hundreds of letters she wrote to her brother, more than half have been lost. The rest are here in Philadelphia. The bulk of the correspondence between Benjamin and Jane Franklin, though, only surfaced in the year 1928. When 59 letters were auctioned by Sotheby's of London. In 1928, the year those letters were auctioned in London, Virginia Woolf turned her attention to the question of women's writing. She had just finished writing Orlando, a parody of biography that took up themes that she had long wrestled with, especially in the lives of the obscure, a meditation on books shelved and faded out of date, obsolete libraries, biographies of nobodies. Woolf wrote, "The obscure sleep on the walls, slouching against each other as if they were too drowsy to stand upright. Why disturb their sleep?" It was in October of 1928 that Virginia Woolf delivered a series of lectures to women undergraduates at Cambridge University that were soon after published as A Room of One's Own. What, she wanted to know, would have happened had Shakespeare had a wonderfully gifted sister called Judith? I've always wondered where she got that idea. And I think maybe that fall, Virginia Woolf, casting about for ideas for a lecture series, rummaging about in bookstores, came across a catalog from Sotheby's of London, slumbering upon a shelf, whose entry read, "A most remarkable and extensive series of letters written by Benjamin Franklin to his sister Jane." And I like to think that in order to read those words, in order to imagine both Judith and William Shakespeare, to think about both Jane and Benjamin Franklin, Virginia Woolf had first to put on her spectacles. Thank you. I would be delighted to take questions. If you could wait for a microphone to arrive to you, that would be terrific. But just raise your hand and I'll... Yes, in the green.
Hi. I have some questions, and it's great that you did this. I am wondering if Ben Franklin ever returned home to see her. And also, he had a lot of nephews who manned printing shops all over the colonies. Were any of them her children?
What terrific questions. This is why you come to Philadelphia to talk about the Franklins. Yay! Yes, he did. He joked that he visited Boston every year that ended in the digit 3. Which he did. He went in 1723, 33, 43, 53, and then I think that was it. he went in 23 to sort of show off that he had become, you know, a printer. And then he went in 33 to visit Jane, and actually he brought her to the Ladies' Library that year. I don't know why he went in 43. Oh, he was Postmaster General or Deputy Postmaster General. He was inspecting the post roads in New England. He stayed at Jane's house. Every time he stayed with Jane. He went in 53 to get an honorary degree from Harvard, which must have felt good after having not been able to afford to go. So he saw her every 10 years. But they actually spent time together because when the revolution began and Boston was occupied by the British, Jane fled. She packed all of her belongings into little trunks and fled the city, saving all the letters Franklin had sent to her that she kept in this little trunk miraculously. She fled first to Rhode Island, and then John Adams got word to Benjamin Franklin that Jane had survived the attack. And Franklin was at the Continental Congress, and he made it necessary that somehow he had to go to meet George Washington in Cambridge. So I had to talk to him about something. So he went up to get Jane, and he stopped to get Jane and brought her back to Philadelphia. She spent the beginning of the Revolutionary War here in Philadelphia living in his house. So, you know, when the Continental Congress is meeting and Thomas Paine's over having dinner, Jane's there. The problem is the sad thing when people are in the same house, it's worse because they don't write letters. So as a historian, you actually hate it when people see one another. The nephews. Yeah, so Jane's third son, she named her first son after her father, her next son after her husband, her third son after her brother. This is what you would commonly do. So her third son, Benjamin Meekham, became a printer. Franklin arranged for him to be apprenticed first with a former apprentice of Franklin's in New York, and then he set him up with a print shop in Antigua. It's a very convoluted tale. Benny Meekham is one of the Meekhams who goes in violently insane. But Franklin writes The Way to Wealth for Benny Meekham. The set of Poor Richard's Proverbs about how industry begets riches because Meekham keeps failing. Franklin really wants him to succeed so that he can take care of his mother. There's a gentleman way back here. Can you just wait for the microphone, please?
Thanks. Just a question. Do you have any knowledge as to whether or not Jane and Abigail Adams had any, you know, relationship? Or obviously they knew they knew of each other, I would assume, but
Well, Franklin knew Adams, and John Adams, of course, quite hated Franklin. But like sort of I know this is not meant to make fun of your question, but it's sort of like saying, like, did my mother know Hillary Clinton? Like, there's a completely different social and especially economic circle. Jane Franklin was a very poor woman struggling as a widow in the seaport of Boston. Abigail Adams was quite a learned and sophisticated woman, an extraordinarily learned and sophisticated woman of her day, who traveled the world with John Adams, went to London and Paris with him, was just a much more cosmopolitan person. So I have no reason to believe they would ever have known one another. People that Jane liked, I have a chapter in the book about this fascinating wax artist named Patience Wright, who Jane adores because she makes these wax people, which Jane makes soap and making like waxworks people is a little bit like that. And she makes the waxwork people by heating up the wax by putting it between her thighs, and then she works it under her skirts and gives birth to these like heads. So Jane thinks this is awesome, and she just thinks like that's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And she writes Franklin a letter because Patience Wright's husband's died and she's going to go to London and try to become a kind of artist to the court. And Jane, she comes to Boston and Jane writes a letter of recommendation for her, you know, dear brother, you must meet this Patience Wright. She's wonderful. Abigail Adams calls Patience Wright the queen of sluts. And I'm just saying, like, this is a different class of woman. Like, this, she did not think that was cool the way Jane thought that was cool. He's here with the scarf.
Were books of ages common at that time? Because I saw that on that page, her death was also written. So how do you know that that's...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, her death is written because her grandson inherits the Book of Ages and then he puts his own stuff in it. So yes, actually people, there were no birth certificates and no vital statistics. So if you wanted to know what when anyone was born, you had to write it down. Because people, actually most people didn't know even how old they were, but very few people knew their actual birthday. But if you had a family, like a mother or father who wanted to note that, you might take a scrap of paper and write these things down and then slip it into a Bible. Most people would have a Bible, maybe, or an almanac, or use like the blank pages in an almanac to do that. People kept these records all the time, mainly because they just wanted to remember how old everybody was or what years people died. And people did, you'd often do it in your Bible. So by the 19th century, if you know, like in my family Bible, we have a page that is the family record. Like it's printed. It's a printed piece in the Bible. It's like a blank, and you're supposed to write in all these things. Bibles then become printing. They begin printing these pages as a form that you fill out. But that's because people just used to use the blank pages. Paper was really not something people had available. So what's unusual for Jane is that she kind of did her own little book, made her own little book out of it. But other people do that too. She's not the only person to do that. I've never seen anybody call it a Book of Ages. The phrase seems to be really her own, and it's used in liturgically to mean a book of the dead. So it's a kind of devotional form rather than a pure chronicle. But yes, people would very often do that. She offers prayers. We didn't look at these together. It's not just a list. And that's another purpose that she put this form to, which is very interesting. She actually stops using it though in 1767, long before she dies, because she just can't stand it anymore. It's too sad. That's why the pages are blank. Her favorite daughter dies, and that's when she writes, you know, what have I more? And then she closes the book, and that's it. There's a woman way, way in the back there.
Way in the back?
You, yes, you.
Am I the one that you're pointing to? No. Oh, go ahead. All right, I just have a very quick question. Could you tell me where the letters are?
Oh, the letters are largely here at the American Philosophical Society.
Okay. Hi. I realize this is asking for speculation, but if Jane Franklin had been male, do you think she would have had similar success to her brother, or do you think she would have lived her life like Benjamin Franklin's other 9 brothers who didn't have the same opportunities?
You know, I don't think we can know. We can't know. I mean, I guess the other way to pose that same question would be like, was she an undiscovered genius? But the kind of starving of one's intellect that is being deprived of any kind of an education for years and years and years in that way. You know, when Franklin says, like, oh, and I opened up the Library Company of Philadelphia and I devoted an hour or two each evening. And you're like, she's got 12 kids. I'm sorry. Like, I can't devote an hour each evening. What do I think? Like, I think, in other words, that to me, I find that a more interesting question. Like, what are the limits of the possible in the life that she did lead? Not what would have been possible if she'd led a completely other life. Partly just because I'm an empirical person, I'm not that special. Like, I can't know that, so I don't want to ask it because it makes me sad that I can't know. I like to ask questions I can get to an answer to. And I kind of feel like I can understand. She writes a lot, like, I can't possibly write you a letter because I'm just a bit busy. And he'll be like, well, I'm at the Continental Congress, so I'm busy too. Could we, with the t-shirt here in the center?
What sparked your interest in Jane Franklin?
Oh, that's a great question. I grew up on Franklin Street. You grew up in, like, Franklin Town, so I don't know why all of you aren't interested in Jane Franklin. The street I grew up on in a town in Massachusetts was laid out on the 200th anniversary of Franklin's birth in 1906. And I know, like, you just Franklin this, Franklin that. It gets tiresome. But at some point, so I was the kind of kid, little kid, who, you know, when you read a book that you like, and then you're like, oh, thank God, because this person's written like 40 other books. I'm set for a few weeks. You know, like you're going to read every Ramona the Pest book or whatever. So I still have that. It's a very childish thing, but you know, as an adult, like when I read somebody whose work I like, I don't want to. It's like staying too long to dinner with somebody that you're enjoying dinner with. I'm not. We have time. So listen to you a little. So when I discovered Benjamin Franklin as a writer, I thought, well, I could spend some time with this guy. So you know, the Benjamin Franklin papers have been published volume by volume since the 1950s, and I went to the library one day, I sat down on the floor, and I just pulled one volume down after another, because I was just reading from beginning of his life to his end. And he's delightful. He's charming, generous, fortunate, brilliant, sly, sneaky. You know the man. But that was fun, but every other letter was to this woman named Jane, whom I had never heard of. And I thought, did I miss something? Like, who the hell is Jane Meekum? And there were almost no letters back from her because they don't print the return, you know, it's Franklin's papers, not Jane's papers. So I became fascinated by that. And then I found this book that had been written by Carl Van Doren, who won the Pulitzer Prize for a 1938 beautiful biography of Franklin, who then spent the rest of his life trying to find Jane's papers because he felt the same way that I felt that day in the library. And so he was appointed to the library committee of the American Philosophical Society here and donated his time trying to find those papers. Those papers that were sold by Sotheby's in 1928 in London, Carl Van Doren bought them from the guy who bought them and made them, you know, brought them to Philadelphia. Otherwise, they'd still be in private hands. So I was kind of relieved to know that I wasn't the only person in the entire history of the universe that had noticed Jane, but like I was only the second. So I didn't work on the project for a long, long time. I told my mother about it. I wrote this long essay in The New Yorker this past summer about how my mother kept saying, why are you going to write that book about Jane Franklin? And I kept saying, that book is impossible. Listen to why no one could write that book. And she would be like, so what? Like, write the book, you know, whatever. Like, get this done. And then I'd made progress on it over the years and then abandoned it. And I had abandoned it like 10 times. It was really sad, mainly. I'm not really a sad person. And I found it very, in raising my own children and just thinking about all this death, it actually spooked the hell out of me. And then my father died and my mother was very ill. And I thought, oh, I must, you know, this I must do. And I wrote as fast as I could and I didn't finish it before she died. But the book is a monument to my mother.
Could you talk a little bit about the research? I mean, you've said over and over how scarce the information was. Where did you go? How did you find this person?
Well, Franklin is easy to find. You just have to walk down Market Street. There'll be some guy. He'll have these glasses. You know, have the ball. You know, like, it's actually how to get away from Franklin is more the problem than how to find in a certain kind of way. Like, he looms so large as a myth. It wasn't the finding the sources. The sources are so few, I very quickly realized I'd gotten to the end of them. I mean, I did find things that no one had. Finding her books, I found books that she owned, that she had signed. I one day found in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, I'd gone, made an appointment with the curator to look at this ring that was listed in the catalog as having once belonged to Benjamin Franklin. And I'm thinking, Franklin's not wearing a ring. Not in the portrait. and I went to see it in the it was a mourning ring. People, when someone died, you would give out a memento ring. And it had etched in it the name of the person that was being mourned, Josiah Williams, who's Jane's nephew, and the day of his death. And Jane had actually deeded that ring to her granddaughter in her will, like that specific ring. And it was Jane's ring. And like a lot of things that had once belonged to Jane, it only survived because it had some, or actually in this case, a totally fictitious connection to Benjamin Franklin. So I made them change the catalog entry. But also, when they weren't looking, I took the ring out of its case and I put it on. She's like, I'm never going to be let in there again. But I thought no one else can. No one has asked to look at this ring in a, you know, two centuries. God damn it, I'm going to put it. And it was tiny. Like I could barely get it on my pinky. And I don't have any portrait. Like I thought she must have been this tiny, tiny person. She wore that ring. And I was so glad that it didn't fit me. I don't think that's funny. That was supposed to be sad. Like, I find her life so sad, I just don't want to think about being that cramped and constrained and confined. But so I did have some, to me, very magical and moving moments of finding things. It was more, the question wasn't, it took a lot of years to find these things. But to me, the real obstacle was it's asymmetry. There's so much here's Benjamin Franklin. He's wonderful. And we know what he was doing at 3 o'clock on the 24th of January, like we're playing Clue. You know, Jane, we know nothing. You know, almost, and also, it's not wonderful. And we live in a world of inequality, of grotesque inequality that we cannot bear to think about. I'll tell you, as a historian, it's really hard to think about too. But I felt, and here the turning point for me, aside from, you know, my parents' passing, was we really, as a community, as a people, really need to understand inequality a whole lot better. And historians ought to really be able to help us learn something about it. I think that's a good place to close. So thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.